Welcome, everyone, to the Gravel Ride Podcast. I'm your host, Craig Dalton. This week on the podcast, we've got Yuri Hoswald from Goo Energy Lab. If you've followed the gravel scene at all, you've probably seen Yuri's name come up from time to time. Yuri's a past Dirty Kanza champion, and you'll find him all over the world racing his gravel bike and advocating for people to get outside in his capacity working for Goo Energy Labs. Yuri's got some great tips and tricks around nutrition and hydration that really came to bear in this year's Dirty Kanza, as well as some great insight into suspension for gravel bikes and when we're going to see them start to have some impact in the market. But first, we've got this week's sponsored Tech Corner with Randall from Thesis Bike.
Thanks, Craig.
So today we're going to talk about suspension on gravel bikes. A gravel bike, for me, is a bicycle that performs at a high level on everything from road with a set of road slicks to, you know, borderline cross-country riding with a set of knobby 650Bs. So for a gravel bike suspension, what we want is comfort and control while still maintaining the performance of the bike in all the different conditions it's going to be ridden. So in order, the first thing I would be looking at is my wheel tire package. What I want is a high-volume tire with a supple casing set up tubeless on a rim that's wide enough to support that tire at low pressures without the tire squirming around. Now, the next thing I'd be looking at is seat post. And a traditional seat post can give you some flex, but it's pretty limited. So from there, you might look at a suspension seat post. But really, if you're adding that weight, you might as well add the dropper post. Now, a dropper, again, is going to take the weight off the front wheel, which means off your hands, and put it more over the rear wheel, while at the same time giving you more distance between your butt and your saddle so that you can use your legs as suspension. And that is going to make a considerable difference in the amount of shock absorption of your overall system. Next up, touch points. So cushy bar tape and a slightly cushier saddle than you might run on a pure road bike are going to take a lot of the edge off. They add a trivial amount of weight, and they're relatively inexpensive to add. Now, at this point is where I would stop, but some people might want even more cushion. For them, I'd recommend a suspension stem. What I like about a suspension stem is that it doesn't compromise the structural integrity of your steer tube or the front end of your bike, and it's entirely non-proprietary, so you can swap it in and out of any bike. Now, if all of these things aren't enough, what you might be looking for is a drop bar mountain bike. This means a suspension fork up front or even a rear suspension in the back. However, keep in mind that that sort of bike, while fantastic on the dirt, is going to be a bit compromised on the road because it's going to have some slop and extra weight in the system that are going to take away that snappy feel that you're used to on a road bike with road slicks. What's great about a gravel bike is the ability to ride at a high level on any sort of terrain, whether it be road or dirt. So my take is start with your wheel tire package, add a dropper post, add some cushy touch points, and go have a fantastic ride. Now, back to Craig and this week's guest.
Yuri, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for having me, Craig. I'm stoked to be on.
Right on. I've always wanted to ask you this question every time I've seen you, but can you describe your background as a cyclist? Like, how did you get into the sport, and then what ultimately drew you to the gravel part of the market?
Yeah, that's a good question, because I don't have like sort of the traditional cyclist introduction into the sport. So I was a stick and ball kid growing up, you know, soccer, baseball, football, and lacrosse. And then I just, lacrosse is the sport that took me to college. I played collegiate lacrosse at Cal, and was the captain of the team and MVP and this and that. So that was my sport all through high school and college. And so I had a good like endurance engine from all the running we had to do, but I wasn't riding a bike. And I actually didn't discover the bike until I went and taught at a prep school back east in Pennsylvania. This was 93, 94, 95. And some of the folks I taught with were avid mountain bikers, and they started taking me out on rides. And I was on a borrowed GT like Zaskar in cutoff jeans and Chuck Taylors, no joke, total hack. But I loved it. I loved the adventure of it. I loved the camaraderie of it. That, you know, exploring new places. We were riding out in, like French Creek, park out there, like Jim Thorpe, Pennsylvania, places like that, really rooty technical stuff. So I was constantly wrecking and breaking parts. My first bike actually was a Specialized stump jumper, and I got it because one of my students worked in a bike shop and hooked me up with a little bit of a deal as his teacher on a mountain bike. And then it just went from there. I truly fell in love with the sport and the community around it. And when I moved back to California in 96 is when I really started getting into the race scene and starting to work my way up through the ranks.
And was that on the mountain bike primarily, or did you drift into the road as well?
When I first got into riding, it was only mountain bike. I didn't touch a road bike. I think I got my first road bike. I know when I got my first road bike, it was a Giant. And it was in 96, and my first century was the Santa Fe century because I was working, I had started my master's through St. John's, in literature, and, I was living in Santa Fe, befriended some dudes who just opened up a bike shop, and then one thing led to another. And once I finished my summer, towards my master's, I started working in the bike shop and became full mountain bike dirtbag, and gave up on my master's and started riding bikes and then started teaching elementary school actually. So yeah, that's how I got into it.
And then on the mountain bike side, you started to get drawn to the sort of the more, endurance events. Is that right?
That's true. That took a number of years. That probably took 7, 8, 9 years before I realized that, I wasn't, you know, that good of a cross country racer. I was decent. You know, I mean, I worked my way up all the way to semi-pro, which is a category that doesn't exist anymore. But that was sort of the stepping stone between expert and pro, because that was such a huge gap back in the day to go from being an expert to pro. So they had a semi-pro category and I made it to that category. But there was no way in hell I was going to ever get out of that category because I was just pack fodder. It was actually in 2003 that I did my first 24-hour event as part of a four-man team with Mark Weir, another buddy of mine, Glenn Fant, who's a shop owner up here in Santa Rosa, and a gentleman named Kirk Desmond. We did the 24-hour four-man national championships that were held at Laguna Seca, and we did the geared category, but just as sort of our FU to everybody, we did it on single speeds, and we ended up winning. So we won the four-man national championships in the geared category on single speeds that year. So that was my first introduction to, like, you know, back-to-back hours of going hard for 24 hours. And then it wasn't until a buddy dared me in 2006 to do my first 24-hour solo that I really sort of discovered that I have the ability to sort of be that diesel engine and just pedal at a relatively good pace for long periods of time. And I did multiple years of solo 24-hour racing and had some success with that. And that is actually what allowed me to turn pro. But you know, when I say that, a lot of people think, you know, the endorsements and the big money checks started rolling in, right? And I got to quit my day job. not true. Not true at all. I was really, really nobody. It was just three letters on my license that meant a lot to me. And I still was teaching and, you know, traveling during the summers and living out of my car and following the Norba circuit and racing as much as I can. But I think it was probably around 2007, 2008 that I started doing more of the 8-hour, 12-hour, 100-mile mountain bike kind of racing, and kind of figuring out that that was more my jam than the short XC stuff.
Yeah, I imagine you see a lot of parallels between the type of community that was evolving around the 24-hour scene back in those years with what's going on in gravel today.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, definitely. The 24-hour scene was super familial and supportive, and there was a tight-knit group of us that were pretty close. And that's one of the things that when I discovered Dirty Kansas in 2013, that was the first year I went out there, is what really attracted me to gravel was, you know, Midwestern hospitality, the gravel family. The embrace of that family is warm, it's genuine, and it makes you feel welcome. And, you know, it was that, and, you know, then obviously pushing your physical limits in new terrain and a new sort of discipline of racing that really, attracted me to the gravel scene. And I've been, you know, an avid gravel fan ever since 2013.
Yeah, it seems like some of those early events, they really set the marker from a sort of ultra endurance perspective of gravel. And subsequently, many events have kind of rolled that back to make them a little more accessible. With your 24-hour background, obviously, like going into a 200-mile event wasn't completely foreign, although I'm sure it was really hard that first year in 2013. Where do you think that mix in gravel events is going to land? Do we have room for the ultra endurance side and the shorter events?
I do, you know, I mean, you see events, you know, offering up, you know, gravel events off some offering up, you know, multi distances to kind of appeal to a lot of different folks, something like a Rebecca's Private Idaho, which has, you know, three or four distances, the big one, which is, you know, 100 miles. And then there's like a, I think a 25 mile, and then there's sort of a tweener distance of 60 miles. So, you know, and then you saw that Dirty Kanza 2 years ago, offered, you know, the supersize me, you know, the DKXL, and also has multiple distances underneath the 200, the 100, the 50. And I think they now have a 25, as well. So I think there's plenty of room, to offer a lot of different distances, because gravel appeals to folks who are wanting to get off pavement, you know, and, get onto this sort of the quiet backcountry where you don't see any cars for days kind of events. So I think there's definitely room for growth for events to have multiple distances, and that appeals to a lot of folks.
Yeah, it's been interesting to me as I personally got drawn into the sport. I was an observer from the side about events like the Tour Divide and these sort of long distance, multi-day bikepacking style races. And I never actually did one of those, but I got drawn into the sport just because it was aspirational to be out there having such an adventure. And in my life, I tend towards more of the shorter events just because I don't have the time or the physique or the commitment to kind of train up to those 12, 14 hour events. I really prefer the 6 hour long events, but I totally get your point. I think there's room for it all. And in the lifetime of a gravel cyclist, hopefully we all get the opportunity to push ourselves to something like DK 200, because I think it's just this huge monumental life milestone that you can take away from having achieved something like that.
Oh, most definitely, man. I mean, you talk about, you know, monumental like life achievements. I feel like my finish this year, while my slowest, possibly my worst finish ever, was the most rewarding, because I got to earn the coveted gravel grail this year, which means I finished five, 200s of Dirty Kanza. I also struggled mightily with the heat this year and was showing signs of heat stroke at the last aid station at 150. So, I was really pleased to get through this year and get that grail and not have to return again to do another 200 if I don't want to.
Well, you were certainly not alone. From all accounts I can hear, the people were struggling with that heat, and it's hard enough an event as it is. You probably had an experience that was similar to sort of many of the mid-packers and the tail end experience every year.
Oh, yeah. Possibly, yeah. I mean, I passed so many people sitting under trees. Myself, I was under a tree at times, fixing a couple flats. So yeah, I mean, it's funny, Kansas, the weather always has a way of humbling folks and keeping you honest, whether it's, you know, the wind, whether it's the humidity, whether it's the heat, whether it's rain and mud. Mother Nature always seems to have a hand in how things shake out there in the foothills.
Yeah, I imagine you got to try to control the things you can and just accept the things you can't in an event like that.
Yeah. And I know how to sort of mitigate, having had heat stroke a few times. I know how to try to keep it at bay a little bit. So I had my pit was prepared for me when I came in at 150 with ice, and I was wearing sun sleeves. So we shoved ice bags onto my wrists, because that's one of the spots to bring your core temp down, and, you know, ice on my back. And I had a frozen camelback waiting for me, and yeah, so they were able to sort of patch me up and push me along my way. And I didn't lose too much time, you know, maybe 3 minutes or something like that in that last pit. But those last 50 miles were really, really difficult for me.
So did you roll out of that last pit with the ice bags kind of just strapped to your body wherever they could fit?
Yeah, so we put ice inside pantyhose and you tie them off. So they make nice little porous ice bags that melt on you. And so we shoved two into the sleeves that I had on my arms, right on my wrists. My Camelback had a reservoir that had been frozen, so the water would slowly melt and hopefully some of that cool heat would go through onto my back. Then we had multiple cold towels and other ice bags shoved around my neck and down my jersey. And that was about it. A kick in the ass and get out of here. Let's, you know, knock out those last 50 miles. So that's how I dealt with it. I overhydrated too, just because I knew that I needed to keep the fluids going in. And I was using our Goose liquid Roctane drink mix because I have a hard time dealing with solids or gels in the heat. So I was going for liquid calories.
Yeah. I was going to ask you about, you know, in the things that you can control, nutrition is obviously one of them. And it's an area where you have a lot of expertise from Goo. Can you walk us through how you approach nutrition for a 200 miler on a hot day?
Yeah, totally. I'd be happy to do that. So, I mean, nutrition, your nutrition plan, I mean, everyone's nutrition plan is going to be unique to their system. So I just want to put the disclaimer out there right now that what works for me, you know, may not work for everybody. And also, since we're talking about disclaimers, that, you know, I am a Goo employee. I've worked for them for 6 years in the office and I've been a Goo athlete for 14 years. So obviously I'm very biased, but I wouldn't be using their products if they didn't work for me. So for me, you know, obviously like the week leading up to an event, you want to be hydrating, sleeping well, mitigating your stress as much as possible, you know, having solid meals just so you're topping up all of your glycogen stores and making sure you have those energy reserves ready to be tapped into come race day. With an event like Dirty Kansas that starts at 6 a.m, I don't typically eat breakfast because that would mean I would have to get up at like 3 if I wanted to eat like a proper breakfast. So I think I got up at 4:30 this year and had a half of a bagel with a little bit of avocado on it. And that was it. My usual cup of coffee or two just to, you know, get things rolling. And then as far as nutrition goes, I only had one, solid bit of food that could be considered, you know, normal food throughout the day. And I relied on our Roctane gels, which have 3 times the branched chain amino acids, our Roctane drink, our electrolyte capsules to help with the humidity and all the, you know, the potassium and sodium that I was losing. And then our Roctane BCAA capsules, which help with mental acuity and they buffer muscle fatigue. So I sort of shoot for 200 to 250 calories per hour. And that could be a combination of, you know, gel and the Roctane drink in my bottles. Maybe some of our chews, which is a chewable form of Goo, but I think I only had one sleeve of those, throughout. So I basically for 13 hours was only using our Roctane drink, which is 250 calories per bottle, and our Roctane gels. And one bit of solid I had was at mile 68 station. I had a Hawaiian bun PB&J little square. But that was about all I could stomach solid, you know, solid food wise. And then it was just tons of water, trying to, you know, eat every 20 to 30 minutes, but it was hard for me to keep track of time because at mile 40, somebody wrecked me out and it snapped my Garmin off my bike and I had to put it in my pocket. So I couldn't look at time, distance, or the turn by turn direction. So I was riding blind actually for the whole day, pretty much after mile 40, trying to stay in groups. And, actually I tasked, I don't know if you know Spencer Pallison, who used to work for Velo News, but we were in a group for a long time. And we've ridden a bunch together. So I asked him to tell me every 20 minutes, like 20 minutes has gone by, and bless Spencer's heart, he'd be like, 20 minutes, dude. He would just shout that out when we were in the group. So I knew I could eat or drink. He'd say, yeah, 20 minutes, Yuri. And so we did that for many miles out on the prairie. So I had a couple other little curveballs thrown at me during the day that sort of threw off my regular, fueling strategy. But I was all liquid calories and gels, along with some capsules. And then I had a little sip of flat Coke at the 150 aid station, but I was afraid that it was going to upset my stomach because I was already dry heaving coming into that aid station. So I was worried about like too much sugar or anything like that, but it tasted really good. So I just had a few sips of that to see if it could like settle my stomach a tad.
That's interesting. I don't usually think about the liquid calories, but it makes sense to kind of take a little bit in there and then supplement it or really supplement your goo nutrition, the gels with the liquid as well each hour.
Yeah. I mean, liquid calories are awesome, especially in the heat, because they're super easy for your body to digest and process. You're not getting, like cotton mouth trying to chew on, some form of solid food. I find it just works really, really well. I mean, case in point, so our Roccane drink was, I think I was one of the early testers of it probably back in like 2009 or 10. But our head of R&D, who's a former Olympian, Magda Boulay, she won Western States, the big iconic 100-mile run in 2015. She ran for 19 hours all on Roccane drinks, so 250 calories per hour. That was her plan. It was super hot that year, and that got her through. So I know, and plus, like I said before, like I've been using our products for over a decade, and so my system is really used to that, and I have a routine. So for folks out there who are listening, they need to pick and choose, find what products work for them, train with it, race with it, and refine their nutrition plan for what works for their system. But for me, like I said, it's our gels and our drink and some of our capsules, and maybe if it's not so hot, bits and pieces of solid food. But when it was as hot as it was out in Kansas, like solid food just does not sound palatable to me. And so I just stuck with the liquids and gels.
Yeah. I think one of the interesting things that riders need to sort of internalize is there is a hard cap as to the amount of calories your body can absorb in an hour.
It's about 350.
Yeah. So going to sort of waiting an hour and a half to binge at an aid station is really going to put you in the hurt locker pretty quickly.
Yeah, because then all of your blood is going to go right to your stomach to try to process that. You've shocked your system because you've just overloaded it. So I have a phrase that I actually stole from my friend Rebecca Rush. I call it the sip, sip, nibble, nibble plan, right? You're just constantly taking in the drip, drip of nutrition, right? Whether it's your fluids or your gels or whatever it is, but little bits of it, every 20 minutes, is way better than, like you said, just throwing a whole bunch down, and hoping your body can process that.
Yeah.
And not slow you down. You know what I mean? At the same time, because, when you throw all those calories into your gut, your body's going to try to process that, which means blood's not going to your muscles, which you need to, keep pedaling your bike, and things can spiral out of control. So I like to adhere to the sip, sip, nibble, nibble nutrition plan.
Yeah. And to remind yourself, I think one of the tips that I employed when I was doing Ironman was I just had an old Timex watch and I set an alarm for every 20 minutes to say, just eat and drink. Remember that no matter what.
Yeah, totally. You could do that. Yeah. I do that on my Garmin sometimes, but I've been doing this for so long. It's just like ingrained in me. I also typically shove a couple gels right in the cuff of my shorts. So they're like, right there on my quads. So I sort of see them when I'm pedaling. It also makes the gels like more liquidy because they get heated up on your leg. And it's just that reminder that, oh yeah, I've got a gel sitting there. I better eat that now. And then, I reload it So I just constantly have these gels sitting on my legs while I'm pedaling that remind me to eat. And it sounds silly, but it is a good visual reminder that you need to eat.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great tip. And the other thing that I saw a lot of on bikes at Dirty Kanza are the bento style boxes.
Yeah, for sure. Those are awesome. I haven't found a bento box though that doesn't rub my legs when I get out of the saddle. Sometimes, you know, I find that when I get out of the saddle, my legs will hit that. So I don't typically ride with a bento box, but that's a great tip too. You know, I wear a Camelback chase vest, which has stowage right on the front chest strap. So your food is right there on your chest too, which is a nice reminder to eat, and you can segment it, you know? So like for me, I'm kind of geeky, or I have these little systems that just keep things square for me when I'm not thinking right. Like the right side of my chest is like all gels. The left side of my chest is like chews and maybe a bar, which I had bars in all of my chase vests, but I never touched a bar for 13 hours. So they're just little things. And like, speaking of geeky things I do, like my Roctane bottle, which is my drink, is always on the cage that's on my seat tube. So I don't even have to think. I know I reach down to my seat tube cage, that is my calories. Water's on the down tube. You know, just little systems that I have in place that have worked for me that kind of keep things straight.
Yeah, I think they're so important. I mean, I fail to be able to do simple math 8 hours into an event. So just sort of having everything where it needs to be so I don't have to think. Getting that reminder that it's time to eat and drink and knowing exactly where to grab. It's just one of those things that you can control, you can train for, that's going to make you more effective.
Yeah, exactly. And at the end of the day, it's less thinking that you have to do, because I kind of go into, I call it sort of robot mode, where I turn off all my non-essential functions with me. And it's really like, I don't think about too much. I'm just pedaling, focusing on my breathing, my eating, and having, you know, my food where I know it exactly needs to be is one less thing I have to think about. I reach into this pocket, a gel is going to come out. I reach into that pocket, you know, maybe something solid is going to come out. I grab that bottle, I know it has calories. Like, just, yeah, it just makes it more, it's like, I don't know, simpler. When, like you say, you're not thinking straight after 8, 10, 12, whatever hours.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, transitioning a little bit, I've wanted to talk to you. I saw you down at Sea Otter, and I know you had the opportunity to ride the Niner full suspension bike down there and spend some time on it here in Marin County. I'm curious to sort of just get your thoughts about suspension in general and where we're going to see it. Is it going to start having an effect in the racing? Will we start seeing pros move to suspension simply because it's faster? You've spent a lot of time on a lot of different types of equipment. What are your thoughts about suspension in the gravel game?
Well, so just a couple disclaimers here, just so you know, everybody's clear. I am sponsored by Lauf, which is the Icelandic company that has pioneered, you know, the front suspension fork of sorts for gravel bikes, and they have a bike also specifically designed for gravel. And yes, Niner is about to release MCR, the Magic Carpet Ride, which is a full suspension gravel bike with a Fox front fork that has about 40 millimeters of dampening, and the rear is about 50. So I've been a huge fan of the Lauf front fork since I got introduced to it probably about 3 years ago. It was a game changer on many, many levels. I mean, probably the most beneficial one is that it dampens, you know, the impact that your hands, your shoulders, your upper body is taking when you're riding, you know, for 10, 12, 13 hours over the flinty hills in Kansas. So it keeps your upper body fresher, less fatigue. You're also able to corner descend better because you're not getting bounced around so much in the front end. You can track better with the front fork, and that fork has about 30 to 40 millimeters of dampening. The biggest thing I noticed with riding the Magic Carpet Ride is the descending. I mean, you can rip the descents on a full set suspension gravel bike for sure. And then the dampening effects too. Just as an aging endurance athlete, like anything that can take the edge off the terrain that'll allow my body to be fresher over 200 miles or whatever the distance is, you know, yes, please, I'll take that. You know, I don't need to get, you know, smashed by a really hard, stiff, light bike at this point in my career. So I think you're going to start seeing more suspension bits enter into gravel. I think you're already starting to see it with some, you know, folks doing like Envy, doing specific gravel bars that maybe have a little bit of, I have those new G gravel bars that have a little bit of, you know, dampening in them, the way that they have done the carbon weave. I think Lauf has a similar bar. The whole full suspension thing, I think Niner's sort of on the front end of that. We'll just have to see how well it goes. I've been enjoying the Magic Carpet Ride for sure. I notice a huge difference, like when you're trying to motor through really chunky stuff, it just takes the edge off. It reminds me of when you see a moto rider like ripping through like the whoop-de-whoop sections and they're just like skimming across the top of all those bumps. I feel like you hit a certain speed on the Magic Carpet Ride and it does the same thing with chunky terrain. You can just really sort of blast through it at a nice high frequency and not get bounced around all over the place. And I had a few opportunities to sort of test that on some group rides and noticed a huge difference. You know, for full disclosure, I've only probably put 300 to 400 miles on that bike. And so I'm looking forward to getting some more miles on it later this summer.
It'll be an interesting choice for consumers to try to figure out, like, is that the bike for me, or am I looking for something that's more on-road and off-road that can do fairly capable off-road, but can also, you know, be my road touring bike or whatever.
True. So then maybe, you know, a traditional gravel bike with just a Lauf front fork is the option for them, because that front fork will allow you to, you know, to get off-road. Yeah, I think a lot of it will be dependent upon what people's, you know, riding tendencies are and what they're looking to do. But the Magic Carpet Ride is awesome for just taking away a lot of the vibrations and the big hits that you take sometimes when riding on gravel roads for hundreds of miles.
Yeah, it was interesting when I interviewed Lauf, they were talking about riding it on the roads, and I couldn't help but think about some of those roads in Sonoma County where having a little bit of front suspension might be helpful.
For sure. Yeah, it makes a huge difference. And, you know, there's not a huge weight penalty. I think what you gain in, you know, comfort and speed and cornering and stuff like that outweighs any weight disadvantage that fork might have.
Interesting. Well, I know you've got a busy calendar coming up and a bunch of great gravel events. One of the ones I want to highlight, and it was on a recent episode of the Gravel Ride podcast, was the Adventure Revival Ride in Marin. Tom Boss mentioned your name and said, hey, if it wasn't for Yuri, we really wouldn't have been thinking about this at this year. So I'm excited. What's going on with that ride?
Oh, that was so, I'm blushing. That was so nice of Tom Boss. Thank you, Tom. I've known Tom for a long time. That's awesome. Well, Adventure Revival is a collaborative event between Marin County Bicycle Coalition and the NorCal High School League, which my wife is the ED of. And both programs have team trail stewardship programs that they are promoting. And one of the best things about this ride is that the registration fees are going to go help support these team trail stewardship programs so that we're able to develop the next generation of stewards who are going to be maintaining, hopefully creating new trails, particularly, you know, in a zone like Marin where trail access, trail creation is kind of a contentious, you know, topic at times with folks. And so we came together, a group of us. I was working closely with Matt Adams, one of the owners of Mike's Bikes. They're a huge supporter of this event. We put together a really rad route that is incorporates a little bit of pavement, some fire road, maybe a little bit of single track. That highlights some really cool zones in Marin. And it's going to be based out of Fairfax. It's September 7th. We'll have great food, beer, music. But people can know that like their registration dollars are going to benefit, you know, things that will help, you know, our future as cyclists, as people who enjoy playing in the outdoors. And, you know, it's possibly, you know, creating, you know, like kids that might go work for, you know, the park system or, you know, other groups that are all about trail advocacy. So I'm really excited to be a part of this event. So GOO will be one of the nutrition sponsors, but it's super fun working with passionate folks like Tom and Mike and my wife and Dana, and other folks, to bring an event like this to life. Cause it's the first of its kind in Marin, a gravel, you know, ride kind of, I wouldn't call it a race per se. But yeah, it's going to be a great day. September 7th. If you haven't signed up, do it, people.
Yeah, definitely. I'm excited about it being obviously here in Mill Valley in Marin County. I'm really excited to get athletes from other parts of the Bay Area and hopefully other parts of the country to come in and sample what we have. Cause I do think it's an amazing area, and having covered the scene for, you know, as long as I have, I get jealous that other parts of the country have these marquee events and we've yet to kind of establish one in Marin County.
Yeah, it's true. You know, it's tough. I mean, we live in one of the most beautiful places in the world, but that also sort of, you know, restricts what we can do too, because there's so much private land and there's so many restrictions on who can use what trail and this and that. Whereas, you know, you look at somewhere like the Flint Hills of Kansas and you have, you know, this grid network of thousands of miles, right, of empty gravel roads. You know, you look at Rebecca's Private Idaho, same sort of deal. So yeah, it is cool that we're finally able to pull something like this together, get all the right permits, the permission. That's where, you know, Tom's expertise comes in, you know, having worked for years with advocacy and other groups and stuff like that. So yeah, it's cool. Yeah. Hopefully we sell it out and it's an event that, continues to grow in years to come.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Tom was describing how I think he had to work with three different land ownership organizations to get the route knocked out this year, which, I mean, for the average race promoter would probably be prohibitive to even pull it off.
For sure. And then, you know, and then there's certain groups that get their noses bent, you know, that we're doing this or they weren't involved. And it can be complicated, but, hopefully at the end of the day, people see that this is all about the kids really, and our future and creating stewards that will want to protect and, you know, expand the growth of trail access here in Marin. And maybe that will ripple out into other parts of the country too. So yeah, stoked for Adventure Revival on September 7th.
Yeah. Well, thanks for all the time today, Yuri. I appreciate it. I appreciate your years of advocacy and participation in the gravel community. You've really been a sort of a good steward for the gravel brand, if you will.
Oh, thanks. Yeah. I was an accidental, gravel devotee. I mean, really, like I said, 2013, I had no idea what I was getting into when I went out to my first 30 Kansas. No clue whatsoever. I went out there because GOO was a sponsor to check it out, and I fell in love with it. So, yeah, I'm proud to be part of the crew that's helping push it here in California. And, you know, also seeing Northern California athletes like Amity Rockwell, like Allison Tetrick, do really well at, you know, these iconic events like Dirty Cans and stuff like that makes me really proud. Let's keep singing its thanks and praises.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, good luck in everything you've got upcoming. And if I don't see you before, I'll definitely see you in September at Adventure Revival.
Awesome. Thanks, Craig. Been great chatting with you.
Big thanks again to Yuri for coming on the podcast this week. Yuri's been an amazing advocate for the sport of gravel cycling and has always been super approachable. So when you find him out there in an event, go up and give him a high five. I don't know about you, but I took away some really helpful tips from Yuri this week in terms of how to handle nutrition for long events, the value of having a system for where you put things so you just don't have to think, and the value of having a timer to remind you to eat and drink and to know what you're going to eat and drink. I think all of these things add up, and they're in the category of things you can control when preparing for a big event. So that's it for this week. Big thanks to our sponsor, Thesis Bike, for the Tech Corner. And another reminder to just hit subscribe on your favorite podcast app, as we're doing a bit of planning for the upcoming year, and we'd like to know how many of you are out there listening. As always, feel free to hit me up on Instagram or Facebook, or shoot me an email, craig@thegravelride.bike. We look forward to hearing from you. Until next time, here's to finding some dirt under your wheels.